Camarasaurus, Brachiosaurus, and Diplodocus. Camarasaurus had the usual sauropod body, long neck that could reach several stories into the trees, small head with chisel-shaped teeth for stripping leaves, a massive frame that was about 50 feet, 15 meters long, and weighed around 20 tons. It was probably the type of tasty plant guzzler that Big Al and the other Allosauruses liked to eat, although its freakish size would have afforded it quite a lot of protection from even the scariest flesh-eaters. Maybe it was a Camarasaurus like this one that gave Big Al some of those nasty injuries. Camarasaurus is one of many enormous sauropods that have been found in the Morrison Formation. It's joined by its famous cousins, the big three of Brontosaurus, Brachiosaurus, and Diplodocus. Then there are the under-the-radar players known only to the Cognoscenti, or perhaps your average dinosaur-obsessed kindergartner, Apatosaurus, Barosaurus, and further on down the roster, Gallimopus, Catadocus, Dislocosaurus, Haplocanthosaurus, and Suwassia. There are various other sauropods that have been named based on scrappy bones, which may belong to even more species. Now, the Morrison Formation covers a wide swath of time and was deposited across a huge geographic area. Not all of these sauropods lived together, but many of them did. They have been found at the same sites, their skeletons mingled together. The normal situation in the Morrison world was numerous varieties of sauropods cohabiting in the river valleys, their heavy footsteps thundering as they trawled the land in search of the daily hundreds of pounds of leaves and stems that sustained them. What a weird scene to conjure up! It's akin to imagining five or six different species of elephants crowded onto the African savannas, all trying to find enough food to survive while lions and hyenas lurk in the background. The Morrison world was no less dangerous. If a sauropod was staggering around with an empty belly, then you could confidently bet an Allosaurus was hiding in the brush, ready to pounce at the long neck's moment of weakness. In addition to Allosaurus, there were many other predators below it on the food chain. There was Ceratosaurus, a 20-foot-long mid-tier hunter with a frightening horn on its snout. A horse-sized carnivore named Marchosaurus, after the Bone Wars pugilist, and a donkey-sized primitive cousin of T-Rex called Stokesosaurus. Then you had the slashers, a number of lightly built, fast-running pests like Silurius, Ornitholestes, and Tanycolagrius, the Morrison version of cheetahs. And all of these meat gobblers, even Allosaurus, probably lived in fear of another monster that reigned near the top of the food chain. It's called Torvosaurus, and we don't know much about it because its fossils are very rare. But the bones we have paint a terrifying picture. A knife-toothed apex predator that was 30 feet, 10 meters long, and weighed about 2.5 tons or perhaps more, not too far off from the proportions of some of the big tyrannosaurs that would evolve much later. It's easy to understand why so many predators stalked the Morrison ecosystem. There were a lot of sauropods to eat. It's much more difficult to explain how so many of these giant sauropods lived together. It's an even greater puzzle because there were also plenty of other, smaller plant eaters that feasted on shrubs closer to the ground. The plate-backed Stegosaurus and Hesperosaurus, the tank-like ankylosaurs Mimoropelta and Gargoyleosaurus, the ornithischian Camptosaurus, and a whole zoo of small, fast-running fern-chewers like Drinker, Othnelia, Othneliosaurus, and Dryosaurus. The sauropods were also sharing space with all of these herbivores. So how did the sauropods do it? It turns out that their diversity was their key to success. There were many species of sauropods, yes, but they were all slightly different. Some were absolute colossuses. Brachiosaurus was around 55 tons, and Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus tipped the scales in the 30 to 40 ton range. but others were smaller. Diplodocus and Barosaurus were skinny little things, at least as far as sauropods go, weighing a mere 10 to 15 tons. So it goes without saying that some species would need more food than others. These sauropods also had different types of necks. That of Brachiosaurus arched proudly into the heavens with the erect profile of a giraffe, perfect for reaching the highest leaves. But Diplodocus may not have been able to lift its neck much past its shoulders, and may have acted more like a vacuum cleaner, sucking up shorter trees and shrubs. Finally, the heads and teeth of these sauropods differed as well. Brachiosaurus and Camarasaurus had deep, muscle-wrapped skulls and jaws lined with spatula-shaped teeth so they could eat harder foods like thick stems and waxy leaves. But Diplodocus had a long head made up of delicate bones with a row of tiny pencil-shaped teeth at the front of its snout. It would break its teeth if it tried to eat anything too hard. Instead, it spent its time stripping smaller leaves from the branches, its head rocking back and forth like a rake. Different species of sauropods were specialized for eating many different kinds of foods, and they had a lot to choose from, as the lush Jurassic forests were cluttered with towering conifers, with thickets of ferns, cycads, and other shrubs down below. The sauropods weren't competing for the same plants, but dividing the resources among themselves. The scientific term for this is niche partitioning, when coexisting species avoid competing with each other by behaving or feeding in slightly different ways. The Morrison world was highly partitioned, which is a sign of just how successful these dinosaurs were. They were carving up almost every square inch of the ecosystem, a dizzying array of species flourishing alongside each other in the hot, humid, waterlogged forests and coastal plains of ancient North America. But what about late Jurassic dinosaurs in other parts of the world? The story seems to be the same nearly everywhere we look. We also see a similar cast of diverse sauropods, smaller plant-eating stegosaurs, and small to large carnivores of the Ceratosaurus and Allosaurus mode in those other places with rich records of late Jurassic fossils, like China, Eastern Africa, and Portugal. It all comes down to geography. Pangaea had started to break up many tens of millions of years before, but it takes a long time for a supercontinent to split. Land masses can move apart from each other by only a few centimeters each year, about the same pace that our fingernails grow. Thus, there were still big land connections between most parts of the world persisting into the latest Jurassic. Europe and Asia were still globed together, and they were linked to North America by a series of islands that could easily be traversed by a wayfaring dinosaur. These northern lands called Laurasia were beginning to split from southern Pangaea called Gondwana, which was a stuck-together mess of Australia, Antarctica, Africa, South America, India, and Madagascar. Laurasia and Gondwana were intermittently connected by land bridges when sea level was low, and even during times of higher water, other islands provided a convenient migratory route between north and south. The late Jurassic, then, was a time of global uniformity. The same suite of dinosaurs ruled every corner of the globe. Majestic sauropods divided food among them, reaching a peak of diversity unmatched by any other large plant eaters in Earth history. Smaller plant chewers prospered in their shadows, and a motley crew of meat eaters took advantage of all of that herbivore flesh. Some, like Allosaurus and Tovosaurus, were the first truly giant theropods. Others, like Ornitholestes, were the founding members of that dynasty that would eventually produce Velociraptor and birds. The planet was sweltering, and the dinosaurs were able to move around wherever they wanted. This was the real Jurassic Park. 145 million years ago, the Jurassic period transitioned into the final stage of dinosaur evolution, the Cretaceous period. Sometimes the switch between geological periods happens with a flourish, as when the megavolcanoes closed out the Triassic. Other times, it's barely noticeable, and more a matter of scientific bookkeeping, a way for geologists to break up long stretches of time without any major changes or catastrophes. The changeover between the Jurassic and the Cretaceous is that type of boundary. There was no calamity like an asteroid impact or a big eruption that ended the Jurassic. No sudden die-off of plants and animals. No brave new world as the Cretaceous dawned. Rather, the clock just ticked over, and the diverse Jurassic ecosystems of giant sauropods, plate-backed dinosaurs, and small to monstrous meat-eaters continued into the Cretaceous. That's not to say, however, that nothing changed, for plenty was happening to the Earth around the Jurassic-Cretaceous boundary. No apocalyptic disasters, but slower changes to the continents, oceans, and climate occurring over some 25 million years. The hothouse world of the late Jurassic was interrupted by a cold snap, followed by a turn to more arid conditions before things swung back to normal in the early Cretaceous. Sea levels started to fall during the latest Jurassic and stayed low across the boundary until the waters started to rise again some 10 million years into the Cretaceous. With low sea levels came a lot more exposed land, which allowed dinosaurs and other animals to move around even more easily than during the late Jurassic. Pangaea continued to rupture, the fragments of the supercontinent moving farther and farther apart from one another as time marched on. Gondwana, that huge expanse of southern lands, finally began to split, the cracks starting to define the shapes of today's southern hemisphere continents. First, the conjoined mass of Africa and South America detached from the section of Gondwana containing Antarctica and Australia. And then this latter chunk also began to fracture. Volcanoes welled up through the fissures, and although none were on the scale of the monster eruptions at the end of the Permian or Triassic, they would have brought with them the same nasty stew of environment-poisoning lava and gases. None of these changes were particularly deadly on their own, but together they were an insidious cocktail of dangers. The long-term shifts in temperature and sea level were probably unrecognizable to the dinosaurs, the sort of thing that neither they nor any of us, had we been around, would ever have noticed in one lifetime. Plus, in the dinosaur-eat-dinosaur world of the late Jurassic and early Cretaceous, the brontosauruses and allosauruses had more important things to stress over than little changes in the tide line or slightly cooler winters. Given enough time, however, these changes built up and became silent killers. By about 125 million years ago, some 20 million years after the Jurassic ended, a new Cretaceous world had emerged, ruled by a very different suite of dinosaurs. The most obvious change had to do with the most prominent dinosaurs, the gargantuan sauropods. Once so diverse in the late Jurassic Morrison ecosystems, the longnecks suffered a crash in the early Cretaceous. Almost all of the familiar species like Brontosaurus, Diplodocus, and Brachiosaurus went extinct, while a new subgroup called the Titanosaurs began to proliferate, eventually evolving into supergiants like the Middle Cretaceous Argentinosaurus, which at more than 100 feet, 30 meters long, and 50 tons in mass, was the largest animal known to have ever lived on land. But despite the outlandish sizes of the new Cretaceous species, never again would sauropods be as dominant as they were in the late Jurassic. Never again would they boast such a variety of necks and skulls and teeth that allowed them to exploit so many ecological niches. As sauropods suffered, smaller plant-eating ornithischians blossomed, becoming ubiquitous mid-size herbivores in ecosystems around the world. Most famous of these is surely Iguanodon, one of the very first fossils to be called a dinosaur after it was discovered in the 1820s in England. Iguanodon was about 30 feet, 10 meters long, and weighed a few tons. It had a spike on its thumb for defense and a beak at the front of its mouth for snipping plants, and it could switch between walking on all fours and sprinting on its hind legs. Its line would eventually go on to produce the hadrosaurs, or duck-billed dinosaurs, the group of amazingly successful herbivores that thrived at the very end of the Cretaceous alongside their nemesis, T. rex. That was still many tens of millions of years in the future, but those seeds were planted in the early Cretaceous. While the iguanodons were stepping in for the smaller sauropods, there were also changes afoot among ground-feeding herbivores. The plate-backed stegosaurs went into long-term decline, gradually wasting away until the last surviving species succumbed to extinction sometime in the early Cretaceous, snuffing out this iconic group once and for all. Replacing them were ankylosaurs, freakish creatures whose skeletons were covered in armor plates like a reptilian panzer. They had originated back in the Jurassic and remained marginal understudies in most ecosystems, but they exploded in diversity as stegosaurs regressed. Ankylosaurs were some of the slowest, stupidest dinosaurs of all, but they made a living happily chomping ferns and other low-lying vegetation, their body armor making them impervious to attack. Not even the sharpest-toothed predator could get in a good chomp when it had to bite through several inches of solid bone. Then there were the meat-eaters. With so much going on with their herbivore prey, it's no surprise that theropods experienced their own drama as the Jurassic turned into the Cretaceous. A much greater diversity of small carnivores appeared, and some of them started to experiment with weird diets, trading in meat for nuts, seeds, bugs, and shellfish. One group, the scythe-clawed therizinosaurs, even went full vegetarian. On the other end of the size spectrum, a weird clan of large theropods called spinosaurids evolved sails on their backs and long snouts full of cone-shaped teeth and moved into the water, where they started behaving like crocodiles and eating fish. However, as is usually the case when it comes to theropods, the most gripping storyline concerns the apex predators. Like their smaller brethren, the top of the food chain supercarnivores also experienced massive upheaval across the Jurassic Cretaceous boundary. These species are some of my favorites, because the very first dinosaurs that I studied, as an undergraduate working with Paul Serino during those same summers we dug up late Jurassic sauropods in Wyoming, were giant theropods from the early Cretaceous of Africa. When I was a teenager, I watched movies and listened to music and went to baseball games, the normal stuff. But my hero wasn't some athlete or actor. He was a paleontologist. Paul Serino, the National Geographic explorer in residence, dinosaur hunter extraordinaire, leader of expeditions all over the world, and one of People magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People in the issue with Tom Cruise on the cover. I was a dinosaur-obsessed high schooler, and I followed Serino's work like a rock star's groupie. He taught at the University of Chicago, not too far from where I lived, and he grew up in Naperville, Illinois, a suburb where some of my cousins were from. He was a local kid who did good, who became a celebrity scientist and adventurer, and I wanted to be like him. I met my hero when I was 15 years old when he was lecturing at a local museum. I'm sure Paul was used to meeting fanboys, but I upped the weird factor when I shoved a manila envelope in his face, so full of photocopied magazine pages that it couldn't be sealed shut. You see, I was also a budding journalist at the time, or at least I thought I was, and I was churning out articles for amateur paleontology mags and websites at a pace that bordered on the creepy. Many of them were about Paul and his discoveries, and I wanted him to see the things I had written about him. My voice cracked as I handed him the envelope. It was awkward, but Paul was very nice to me that afternoon, and after a long chat, he told me to keep in touch. I met him a few more times over the next couple of years. We exchanged a lot of emails, and when I decided to put journalism aside and dive into paleontology as a career, there was only one college that I wanted to attend, the University of Chicago, so I could learn under Paul. Chicago accepted my application, and I enrolled in the autumn of 2002. During freshman week, I met with Paul and begged him to let me work in his basement fossil lab, where his newest treasures from Africa and China were being revealed, entirely new dinosaurs coming into focus as sand grains were scrubbed away from the bones. I would do anything, even wash the floors or clean the shelves. Thankfully, Paul channeled my enthusiasm elsewhere. He began by teaching me how to conserve and catalog fossils, and then one day he had a surprise. "How would you like to describe a new species of dinosaur?" he asked while leading me to a row of cabinets. Spread in front of me, in drawer after drawer, were fossils of early to middle Cretaceous dinosaurs that Paul and his team had recently brought back from the Sahara Desert. About a decade earlier, after concluding his wildly successful expeditions to Argentina that netted the primitive dinosaurs Herrerasaurus and Eoraptor, Paul shifted his attention to northern Africa. At the time, little was known about African dinosaurs. A few excursions led by Europeans during the colonial period had found some intriguing fossils in places like Tanzania, Egypt, and Niger. But once the colonizers left, so too did most interest in collecting dinosaurs. Not only that, but some of the most important African collections, made by the German aristocrat Ernst Stromer von Reichenbach from the early to mid-Cretaceous rocks of Egypt, weren't around anymore. They had the great misfortune of being kept in a museum just a few blocks from Nazi headquarters in Munich and were destroyed by an Allied bombing raid in 1944. When Paul turned his focus to Africa, all he had to go by were some photographs, a few published reports, and a smattering of bones in those European museums that weren't blitzed during the war. That didn't stop him, though. He mounted a reconnaissance trip to Niger in the heart of the Sahara in 1990. His team found so many fossils that they returned again in 1993, 1997, and several times after that. These were arduous trips, proper Indiana Jones-style expeditions, often lasting for several months and afflicted by the occasional bandit attack or civil war. As something of a break, they took a year off and visited Morocco in 1995. There, too, they uncovered a bounty of bones, including the gorgeously preserved skull of a giant flesh-eater called Carcharodontosaurus, a dinosaur that Stromer had originally named based on a partial skull and skeleton from Egypt that were among those fossils incinerated in the Munich Museum. All told, Paul's African expeditions collected some 100 tons of dinosaur bones, many of which still sit at a warehouse in Chicago waiting to be studied. Those dinosaurs not in the warehouse are inventoried at Paul's lab, and these were the bones laid out before me. Some belonged to a weird sauropod called Nigersaurus, a plant-inhaling machine with hundreds of teeth packed into the front edge of its jaws. There were several elongate vertebrae of the fish-eating spinosaurid Suchomimus, the bones that supported the tall sail that extended along its back. Nearby was the gnarly textured skull of a carnivore called Rugops, which probably scavenged carcasses as much as it hunted. And these fossils weren't only dinosaurs. There was the man-sized cranium of the 40-foot-long crocodilian Saurischius, appropriately nicknamed Super Croc by the media-savvy Serino, and the wing bones of a large pterosaur, and even some turtles and fish. All of these fossils came from rocks that formed over some 10 to 15 million years of the early to middle Cretaceous, in river deltas and along the shores of warm tropical seas fringed by mangrove forests, back when the Sahara was a steamy, swampy jungle instead of a desert. As my eyes darted among the fossils, the cast of characters expanding as each drawer opened, Paul stopped and picked up a bone. It was part of the face of a huge meat-eating dinosaur that looked to be almost as big as T-Rex. There were other things in the same drawer, a piece of a lower jaw, some teeth, and a fused mass of bones from the back of the skull, which would have surrounded the brain and ears. Paul recounted how he'd discovered the specimens a few years back in a desolate part of Niger called Igwidi, just west of a desert oasis, in red sandstones left by a river between 195 million years ago. He could tell that they were similar to the Carcharodontosaurus bones that he'd collected in Morocco, but the match wasn't perfect. He wanted me to figure out the discrepancy. I was 19 years old, and this was my first taste of the detective work that goes into identifying dinosaurs. It was intoxicating. I spent the remainder of the summer scrutinizing the bones, measuring and photographing them, comparing them with other dinosaurs. I concluded that the bones from Niger were indeed very similar to the Moroccan skull of the species Carcharodontosaurus sahericus, but found that there were also so many differences that the two could not have belonged to the same species. Paul agreed, and we wrote up a scientific paper describing the Niger fossils as a new dinosaur, a close but distinct relative of the Moroccan species. We called it Carcharodontosaurus igwidiensis. It was the alpha predator of those humid seaside ecosystems of mid-Cretaceous Africa, a 40-foot-long, 3-ton beast that lorded over all of the other dinosaurs that Paul had been trawling out of the Sahara. There was a whole group of dinosaurs like Carcharodontosaurus that lived throughout the world during the early to middle Cretaceous. They are named, perhaps unoriginally, the Carcharodontosaurs. Among the family album are three species, Giganotosaurus, Mapiosaurus, and the hauntingly named Tyrannotitan, all from South America, which during the early to middle Cretaceous was still connected to Africa. Other siblings lived farther afield, Acrocanthosaurus in North America, Xiaochilong and Kelmaeosaurus in Asia, and Concavenator in Europe. And there's also another one from the Sahara called Eocarcharia, which Paul and I described based on some skull bones he found on another expedition to Niger. It was about 10 million years older than Carcharodontosaurus and only about half the size. It was about as brutish as a dinosaur could get, with a gnarled knob of bone and skin above each eye that gave it an evil scowl and may have even been used to headbutt prey into submission. These Carcharodontosaurs fascinated me. They were basically doing what tyrannosaurs would do many tens of millions of years later, supersizing their bodies, developing an arsenal of predatory weapons, and terrorizing every living thing from their undisputed perch at the top of the food pyramid. Where did they come from? How did they spread around the world and become so dominant? And then, what happened to them? There was only one way to answer these questions. I needed to build a family tree. Genealogy is a key to understanding history, which is why so many people, me included, are obsessed with our own family trees. Knowing the connections among kin helps to untangle how our families have changed over the centuries, when and where our ancestors lived, when a migration or an unexpected death occurred, how the family merged with others through marriages. The same with dinosaurs. If we can read their family tree, or their phylogeny, as paleontologists technically call it, we can use it to illuminate their evolution. But how do you make a family tree for dinosaurs? Carcharodontosaurus doesn't have a birth certificate, and the ancestor of Giganotosaurus wasn't granted a visa when it left Africa for South America. But there is another type of clue coded in the fossils themselves. Evolution causes change over time, particularly in the appearances of organisms. When two species diverge from each other, usually only minor differences separate them, and you may have a hard time telling them apart at a glance. But as time ticks on and the two lineages go their separate ways, they become more and more different from each other. It's the same reason that I look a lot like my father, but barely resemble my third cousins. The other thing evolution occasionally does is produce new things, an extra tooth, or a horn sticking out of the forehead, or a mutation that causes a finger to be lost. These novelties will be inherited by the descendants of the first critter to develop them, but they won't be seen in cousins that had already split off and started evolving down their own path. I've inherited all kinds of things from my parents, and my children will then inherit those things from me. But if my cousin suddenly goes weird and grows a set of wings, they can't be passed on to me, because there is no direct line of descent between us. That means, thankfully in this case, that none of my children get those wings either. Genealogy, therefore, is written into the way we look. On the whole, dinosaurs with similar skeletons are probably more closely related to each other than to other species that look drastically different. But if you want to know if two dinosaurs truly are close brethren, you need to look out for those evolutionary novelties, because animals that possess a newly evolved feature, like an extra finger, must be more closely related to each other than the ones that don't have it. That's because they must have inherited that novelty from a common ancestor, which developed the feature and started an evolutionary domino effect of passing it down the bloodline, generation by generation. Any species with that extra finger is part of the bloodline. Anything without it is likely on another side branch of the family tree. So to build a genealogy of dinosaurs, we need to pore over their bones, find a way to assess how similar and different they are, and identify evolutionary novelties and which subsets of the dinosaurs in question share them. When I became intrigued by Carcharodontosaurs, I began to track down as much information on each species as I could. I visited museums to study skeletons firsthand, and I gathered photographs, drawings, published literature, and notes from some of the more exotic fossils in faraway places that were inaccessible to an unfunded undergraduate. The more I looked, I recognized features of the bones that varied among species. Some Carcharodontosaurs had deep sinuses surrounding their brain, others did not. The giant ones like Carcharodontosaurus had massive blade-like teeth that kind of resembled those of sharks, hence its name, which means shark-toothed lizard, but the smaller species had much daintier chompers. The list went on until I had come up with 99 different ways that some of these predators differed from others. Now it was time to make some sense out of this information. I turned my list into a spreadsheet. Each row a species, each column one of the features of the anatomy, each data cell filled with a 0, 1, or 2, denoting the different versions of each feature seen in that species. Dainty teeth in Eocarcharia, 0. Sharky teeth in Carcharodontosaurus, 1. Then I opened the spreadsheet in a computer program that uses algorithms to search through the maze of data and generate a family tree. It pinpoints which anatomical features are novelties and then identifies which species share them. This may sound trivial, but the computer is necessary because the distribution of novelties can be complicated. Some are seen in many species. Those big sinuses around the brain are present in most Carcharodontosaurs. Others are much rarer, like the shark-mimic teeth, which are seen only in Carcharodontosaurus, Giganotosaurus, and their closest kin. The computer is able to take all of this complexity and recognize a Russian doll pattern. If two species share many novelties between only themselves, they must be each other's closest relatives. If those two species share other novelties with a third animal, those three must be more closely related to one another than to the remainder of the dinosaurs. And so on, until a complete family tree has been drawn. This whole process is what we in the business call a cladistic analysis. My family tree of Carcharodontosaurs helped me unravel their evolution. First, it clarified where these colossal carnivores came from and how they rose to glory. They got their start in the late Jurassic and are very close relatives of that most terrifying predator of the Jurassic, the butcher itself, Allosaurus. In effect, they evolved from a legion of hypercarnivores that was already incumbent in the apex predator niche, and then they escalated things further by becoming larger, stronger, and fiercer when their ancestors went extinct at the end of the Jurassic 145 million years ago, during that long night of environmental and climate change. Did they drive these other allosaurs to extinction, or take advantage when they succumbed for other reasons? We don't yet know the answer. In either event, the Carcharodontosaurs found a way to usurp the place of their forebears, and as the Cretaceous dawned, the kingdom was now theirs. For the next 50 million years or so, deep into the Middle Cretaceous, the Carcharodontosaurs ruled the world. The genealogy also gives insight into something else, why these flesh-gouging monsters lived where they did. Because they originated when most of the continents were still connected during the late Jurassic, the first Carcharodontosaurs easily spread around the world. As time went on and the continents fragmented further, different species became isolated in different areas. The structure of their family tree shows this. It reflects the motion of the continents. Some of the last Carcharodontosaurs to evolve were a clan of South American and African species. South America and Africa remained connected to each other long after links with North America, Asia, and Europe were severed. Isolated south of the equator, the members of this clan, Giganotosaurus, Mapusaurus, and the Carcharodontosaurus from Niger that I studied with Cirino, grew to sizes previously unheard of for meat-eating dinosaurs. Nevertheless, as ferocious as these Carcharodontosaurs were, they wouldn't stay on top forever. Living alongside them, in their shadows, was another breed of carnivore. Smaller, faster, brainier. Their name? The Tyrannosaurs. They would soon make their move and begin a new dinosaur empire. 5. The Tyrant Dinosaurs. One sweltering summer day in 2010, a backhoe operator in the southeastern Chinese city of Guangzhou heard a loud crunch. He expected the worst. His crew was racing to finish an industrial park, a sprawling monotony of offices and warehouses of the sort that I've seen crop up all over China during the past decade. Any delay could be pricey. Maybe he had hit impenetrable bedrock, an old water main, or another nuisance that would stall the project. When the dirt and smoke cleared, however, he didn't see any mangled pipes or wires. There was no bedrock in sight. Instead, something very different came into focus. Fossilized bones. Lots of them. Some of them enormous. Construction halted. The workmen didn't have any advanced degrees or training in paleontology, but he realized his discovery was important. He knew it must be a dinosaur. His homeland had become the epicenter of new dinosaur discoveries, the place where about half of all new species are being found these days. So he called over his foreman, and that is when the madness began. This dinosaur had been buried for more than 66 million years, but now its fate was down to the kind of quick decisions that unfold during a crisis. Words started to leak out. In a panic, the foreman called a friend from town, a fossil collector and dinosaur enthusiast known to posterity only as Mr. Shi. Grasping the gravity of the discovery, Mr. Shi, his honorific and hazy surname recalling one of those shadowy characters in a Bond film, raced to the worksite and rang up some mates at the town's Mineral Resources Department, a branch of the local government. The game of telephone continued, and the agency was able to round up a small team to gather the bones. It took them 6 hours, but they collected every scrap they could find. They filled 25 bags with dinosaur bits and took them to the town's museum for safekeeping. Their timing was perfect. Ominously so. Just as the team was finishing, 3 or 4 fossil traffickers appeared on the scene. Like bloodhounds, these black market hucksters caught the scent of a new dinosaur and wanted to buy it for themselves. A little bit of bribe money would turn into a major payday if they sold the new dinosaur to some wealthy foreign businessman with a taste for exotic fossils. This kind of thing is all too common in China and in many other parts of the world, although it is often against the law. It is heartbreaking to think of the fossils that have been lost to the dark underworld of illegal dealing and organized crime. But this time, the good guys won. When scientists examined the fossils in the safety of the local museum and began to piece together the bones, they quickly recognized how incredible this new discovery was. It wasn't just a jumble of random bones, but a nearly complete skeleton of a predatory dinosaur, one of the massive, sharp-toothed behemoths that always seem to play the villain in films and television documentaries. And the skeleton looked similar to a famous dinosaur from halfway around the world, the great Tyrannosaurus rex, which stalked the forests of North America at about the same time that these red rocks from Guangzhou, which the backhoe operator was plowing through to lay his foundation, were formed. Then it clicked. They were looking at an Asian tyrannosaur. The ferocious ruler of a 66-million-year-old world of dense jungles, sticky with humidity all year round, with swamps and the occasional quicksand pit peppered in between the ferns, pines, and conifers. It was an ecosystem teeming with lizards, feathered omnivorous dinosaurs, sauropods, and swarms of duck-billed dinosaurs, some of which got caught in the slushy death pits and were preserved as fossils. The ones lucky enough to survive were tasty prey for the creature the workmen stumbled upon by pure chance, one of the closest relatives of T-Rex. That blessed workman. He had made a discovery of the sort most paleontologists dream of. Lucky for me, this was a finding that I got to be part of without having to do the hard work of hunting it myself. A few years after the craziness of that late summer day in Guangzhou, I was at a conference at the Burpee Museum of Natural History in the frozen winter wasteland of northern Illinois, just up the road from where I grew up. Scientists from around the world had gathered to discuss the extinction of the dinosaurs. Earlier in the day, I was mesmerized by a presentation from Junchong Liu, my eyes opening wider with each slide as photo after photo of beautiful new fossils from China flashed across the screen. I knew Professor Liu by reputation. He was widely regarded as one of China's top dinosaur hunters, a man whose discoveries helped establish his country as the world's most exciting place for dinosaur research. Professor Liu was a star. I was a young researcher, but to my great surprise, Professor Liu approached me. I shook his hand and congratulated him on his talk, and we exchanged a few other pleasantries. But there was urgency in his voice, and I noticed he was clutching a folder thick with photos. Something was going on. Professor Liu told me he had been tasked with studying a spectacular new dinosaur found by a construction worker in southern China a few years before. He knew it was a tyrannosaur, but it seemed peculiar. It was different enough from T. rex that it must be a new species. And it looked kind of similar to a weird tyrannosaur that I had described a few years earlier as a graduate student, a slender, long-snouted predator from Mongolia called Aeloramus. But Professor Liu wasn't sure. He wanted a second opinion. Of course, I offered to help in any way I could. Professor Liu, or Jun Chong, as I soon knew him, told me all about his past, how he grew up poor in Shandong Province on China's eastern coast, a child of the Cultural Revolution who staved off hunger by picking wild vegetables. Then, once the winds of politics changed, he studied geology in college, went to Texas to do his PhD, and came back to Beijing to take up one of the most vaunted jobs in Chinese paleontology, a professorship at the Chinese Academy of Geological Sciences. Jun Chong, a peasant-turned-professor, became my friend. Not too long after we met at the conference, he invited me to China to help him study the new tyrannosaur and write up a scientific paper describing the skeleton. We scrutinized each part of the skeleton, comparing it to all other tyrannosaurs. We confirmed that it was a close cousin of T. rex. A little over a year later, in 2014, we unveiled the workman's chance discovery as the newest member of the Tyrannosaur family tree, a new species that we called Chongosaurus sinensis. The formal name is something of a tongue twister, so we nicknamed it Pinocchio Rex in reference to its funny long snout. The press got wind of the discovery. Journalists seemed to love the silly nickname, and Jun Chong and I were amused to see our faces splashed across the British tabloids the morning after our announcement. Chongosaurus is part of a surge of new tyrannosaur discoveries over the past decade that is transforming our understanding of this most iconic group of meat-eating dinosaurs. T. rex itself has been in the limelight for over a century, since it was first discovered in the early 1900s. It's the king of dinosaurs, a 40-foot-long, 7-ton behemoth on a first-name basis with almost everyone on the planet. Later, during the 20th century, scientists discovered a few close relatives of T. rex that were also impressively large, and realized that these big predators formed their own branch of dinosaur genealogy, a group that we called the Tyrannosaurs, or Tyrannosauroidea in formal scientific parlance. However, paleontologists struggled to understand when these fantastic dinosaurs originated, what they evolved from, and how they were able to grow so large and reach the top of the food chain. These questions have remained unanswered until now. Over the last 15 years, researchers have recovered nearly 20 new tyrannosaur species at locations the world over. The dusty southern Chinese construction site that yielded Chongosaurus is one of the least unusual places where a new tyrannosaur has been found. Other new species have been pried from the sea-battered cliffs of southern England, the frigid snowfields of the Arctic Circle, and the sandy expanses of the Gobi Desert. These finds have allowed my colleagues and me to build a family tree of tyrannosaurs in order to study their evolution. The results are surprising. It turns out that tyrannosaurs were an ancient group that originated more than 100 million years before T. rex, during those golden days of the Middle Jurassic when dinosaurs were beginning to prosper and long-necked sauropods, like the creatures whose footprints we found in that ancient Scottish lagoon, were rumbling across the land. These first tyrannosaurs weren't very impressive. They were marginal, human-sized carnivores. They continued this way for another 80 million years or so, living in the shadows of larger predators, first Allosaurus and its kin in the Jurassic, and then the fierce Carcharodontosaurs in the early to middle part of the Cretaceous. Only then, after that interminable period of evolution in anonymity, did the tyrannosaurs start growing bigger, stronger, and meaner. They reached the top of the food chain and ruled the world during the final 20 million years of the Age of Dinosaurs. The story of Tyrannosaurs begins with the discovery of T. rex, the namesake of the group, in the early days of the 20th century. The scientist who studied T. rex was a good friend of President Theodore Roosevelt's, a boyhood chum who shared Teddy's love for nature and exploration. His name was Henry Fairfield Osborne, and during the early 1900s, he was one of the most visible scientists in the United States. Osborne was president of New York's American Museum of Natural History and of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and in 1928, he even graced the cover of Time magazine. But Osborne was no normal man of science. His blood ran blue. His father was a railroad tycoon, his uncle, the corporate raider J.P. Morgan. He seemed to be a member of every wood-paneled, smoke-filled, good old boys' backroom club there was. When he wasn't measuring fossil bones, he was rubbing shoulders with New York's social elite in the penthouses of the Upper East Side. Osborne is not remembered very fondly today. He wasn't a very nice man. He used his wealth and political connections to push pet ideas on eugenics and racial superiority. Immigrants, minorities, and the poor were seen as enemies. Once, Osborne even organized a scientific expedition to Asia with the hope of finding the very oldest human fossils to prove that his species couldn't possibly have originated in Africa. He couldn't fathom being the evolutionary descendant of an inferior race. No wonder he is often dismissed today as just another bygone bigot. Osborne is probably not the type of guy I would want to have a beer, or more likely a really fancy cocktail with, if I found myself in Gilded Age New York. I speculate, but he might not have sat down with me anyway, leery of my very ethnic-sounding Italian name. Nevertheless, there's no denying that Osborne was a clever paleontologist and an even better scientific administrator. It was in his capacity as president of the American Museum of Natural History, the august institution that rises like a cathedral on the west side of Central Park, where I would later work on my PhD, that Osborne made one of the best calls in his career. He decided to send a sharp-eyed fossil collector named Barnum Brown out to the American West in search of dinosaurs. We briefly met Brown in the last chapter, when a much older version of him was excavating Jurassic dinosaurs in the Howe Quarry in Wyoming. He was an unlikely hero. He grew up in a speck of a village on the Kansas prairie, a coal company town where only a few hundred people lived. Maybe his parents gave him a flamboyant name inspired by the circus showman P.T. Barnum in some attempt to escape the drudgery of their rural life. The young Barnum didn't have many people around to talk to, but he was surrounded by nature, and he became infatuated with rocks and shells. He even started a little museum at his house, something my dinosaur-obsessed younger brother, also growing up in a placid Midwestern town, would later do after seeing Jurassic Park in the cinema. Brown went on to study geology in college, and then made his way from the small town to New York City in his 20s. It was there he met Osborne and was hired as a field assistant, tasked with bringing huge dinosaurs from the unexamined expanses of Montana and the Dakotas to the bright lights of Manhattan, where socialites who had never slept a night outdoors could gawk at the stupendousness of it all. This is how Brown found himself in 1902 in the desolate badlands of eastern Montana. While out prospecting the hills, Brown came across a jumble of bones. Part of a skull and jaw, some vertebrae and ribs, bits of the shoulder and arm, and most of the pelvis. The bones were enormous. The size of the pelvis indicated an animal that stood several meters tall, certainly much larger than a human. and they were clearly the remains of a muscular creature that could run relatively fast on two legs, the characteristic body type of a meat-eating dinosaur. Other predatory dinosaurs had been found before, like Allosaurus, the butcher of the late Jurassic, but none of these were anywhere near the colossal size of Brown's new beast. He was on the cusp of turning 30 years old, and he had made a discovery that would define him for the rest of his life. Brown sent his discovery back to New York, where Osborne was anxiously awaiting the shipment. The bones were so big, they took years to clean up and assemble into a partial skeleton that could be exhibited to the public. This work was mostly done by the end of 1905, when Osborne announced the new dinosaur to the world. He published a formal scientific paper designating the new dinosaur as Tyrannosaurus rex, a beautiful combination of Greek and Latin that means tyrant lizard king, and put the bones on display at the American Museum, as the institution is known among scientists. The new dinosaur became a sensation, making headlines throughout the country. The New York Times celebrated it as the most formidable fighting animal that had ever existed. Crowds flocked to the museum, and when they came face to face with the tyrant king, they were aghast at its monstrous size and dumbfounded by its ancient age, then estimated at some 8 million years old. We now know that it is much older, about 66 million years old. T-Rex had become a celebrity, and so had Barnum Brown. Brown will always be remembered as the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus rex, but this was just the start of his career. He developed such an eye for fossils that he steadily progressed from a fossil-collecting grunt worker to the curator of vertebrate paleontology at the American Museum, the scientist in charge of the world's finest dinosaur collection. Today, if you visit its spectacular dinosaur halls, many of the fossils you'll see were collected by Brown and his teams. No wonder that Lowell Dingus, one of my former colleagues in New York, who wrote a biography of Brown, refers to him as the best dinosaur collector who ever lived. This sentiment is shared by many of my fellow paleontologists. Brown was the first celebrity paleontologist, acclaimed for his lively lectures and a weekly CBS radio show. People would flock to see him as he passed through the American West on trains, and later in his life, he helped Walt Disney design the dinosaurs in Fantasia. Like any good celebrity, Brown was an eccentric. He hunted fossils in the dead of summer in a full-length fur coat, made extra cash spying for governments and oil companies, and had such a fondness for the ladies that rumors of his tangled web of offspring are still whispered throughout the Western American plains. You can't help but think that if Brown were alive today, he would be the star of some outrageous reality show. And probably a politician. A few years after T-Rex stormed New York, Brown was back at it, in his fur coat, scrambling over the badlands of Montana, looking for more fossils. As usual, he found them. This time it was a much better Tyrannosaurus, a more complete skeleton with a gorgeous skull, nearly as long as a man and with over 50 sharp teeth the size of railroad spikes. While Brown's first T-Rex was too scrappy to make a good estimate for the total size of the animal, the second fossil showed that Rex was a king indeed, a dinosaur well over 35 feet long that must have weighed several tons. There was no doubt, T-Rex was the largest and most fearsome land-living predator that had ever been discovered. For the next few decades, T-Rex enjoyed life at the top, the star of movies and museum exhibits around the globe. It battled the giant gorilla in King Kong and terrified audiences in the screen adaptation of Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World. But this fame masked a puzzle. For nearly the entire 20th century, scientists had little idea of how T. rex fit into the broader picture of dinosaur evolution. It was an oddball, a creature so much larger and so dramatically different from other known predatory dinosaurs that it was difficult to place in the dinosaur family album. During the first few decades after Brown's discovery, paleontologists unearthed a handful of close T. rex relatives in North America and Asia. To nobody's surprise, Brown himself made some of the most important of these discoveries, most notably a mass graveyard of big tyrannosaurs in Alberta in 1910. These T. rex